Following the opening ceremony of Cixing Monastery, about 100 cultivators stayed on to participate in the 3-day Chan meditation session on March 17th, 18th, and 19th. Everyone rose early the following morning and experienced a sense of peace in their meditation, due in part to the tranquil atmosphere which pervaded the monastery. Gone was the bustling hubbub of busy downtown Hong Kong. On top of Linghui Mountain, there was only mist lifting silently from the ring of seas beyond the mountains, and the soundless ascent of the sun as it slipped over the horizon and climbed steadily toward the center of the sky, while participants in the session sat absorbed in concentration. It is not so easy to leave inner conflicts behind, however, and although the efficacious energies on the mountains were pure and vibrant, a certain amount of misgiving passed through the minds of the cultivators as they sat down to take the noon meal on that first day of the session. Once the master had convinced the laywomen that they should prepare food for 1,000 people on the day of the opening, they had somehow managed to overestimate, and there were leftovers. The first day of the session, the tables were laden with nothing but those leftovers. Although only the finest delicacies had been offered, nonetheless, the summer's heat had quickly taken its toll, and a faint odor of spoiling food wafted into the nostrils of the hungry meditators. The master, however, seemed to notice nothing strange about the food, and immediately began to eat with relish. The others dared not fail to follow suit, but for many, the lunch period that day was more bitter than the long, painful hours of meditation. The master is always extremely frugal and does not like to waste anything at all. He teaches his disciples to be mindful of the 5 contemplations when eating, so that they will constantly ask themselves whether they deserve the day's food. He also instructs those who work in the kitchens to be very careful not to throw away anything edible. Cixing Monastery was not equipped with ice boxes, and so it was imperative that the leftover food be finished up the following day, so that it would not go to waste. On the second day of the Chan session, there was still food left over from the ceremony. It was again reheated. After filing into the dining hall, everyone just sat and stared dejectedly at the plates before them, while the flies buzzed and the sun beat down. No one could bring himself to take a bite. The master, well aware of the powerful influence false thoughts and discriminations have over people, saw that everyone would probably choose to go hungry that day rather than tackle the 2-day-old leftovers. And as a consequence, the food, which was still perfectly edible, would go to waste. Without hesitation, the master sat down alone at a table set for 10 and began eating the contents of the plate before him with great appetite. When he finished the plate of food, he moved to the next place and began to devour its contents with the same gusto. Finishing that plate of food, he moved on to the third plate and became absorbed in cleaning up its contents. Then he went on to the fourth plate, and in this way he continued around the circular table until he had eaten all the plates of food. Shamed by his example, most of the people in the gathering reluctantly picked up their chopsticks and began to eat their single plateful of food. In this way, the leftovers from the opening ceremonies of the left wing of Cixing did not go to waste. Cixing Monastery became a place of active cultivation. During the years the master resided in Hong Kong, annual intensive 70-day-long meditation sessions were held at the monastery each winter. The sessions were attended by cultivators from all four assemblies, monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen. The monastery also provided a place for people to carry on individual practices, and for those who held the precepts and practiced in accord with Dharma. Much advantage was gained from the quiet yet exhilarating atmosphere of the pure mountain abode. One bhikshu made a vow to cultivate the Bodhyo Samadhi and requested permission to carry on his practice at the monastery. The master personally arranged a room for his cultivation, with the hope that the bhikshu would quickly accomplish his way karma. Bodhyo is a partial transliteration of a Sanskrit word which means standing Buddha and refers to the awesome power of the Buddha, the awesome power of samadhi, and the power of merit and virtue of the cultivator himself. During the 90 days Bodhyo session, the cultivator walks in a circle around the room and does not sleep or rest day or night. The work is to recite the vast six-word name, Namo Amitabha Buddha, constantly without letting the mind wander. In the room there is no bed, no table, no chair, or any other furniture. The session is an extremely difficult one because the cultivator does not sit or lie down for the entire time. As a consequence, his legs inevitably grow sore, his feet swell, his nervous system is taxed to the point of exhaustion, and his energy drains away. In spite of the difficulty, he must continue to walk, for if he stumbles and falls, he has failed to properly complete the session. If a member of the Sangha who is cultivating this bitter practice suddenly is overcome with drowsiness, he can stand still for a while and exercise his arms before resuming his walk. With vigorous cultivation of this practice, the three karmas of body, mouth, and mind will be in harmony, and the cultivator can enter the standing Buddha Samadhi, and see the Buddhas of the ten directions. Then the cultivator will understand his mind and see his true nature, and can realize enlightened understanding and wisdom. Years earlier, a cultivator at Nanhua Monastery had successfully completed 8 Bodhyo sessions, and by doing so, had perfected a certain amount of spiritual skill. This was the monk who helped the master subdue a poisonous snake that had 100 offspring. The monk in Hong Kong who asked the master to allow him to cultivate the Bodhyo Samadhi smoked cigarettes and hadn't cultivated seriously before he made his sudden resolve to undertake the 90-day session. But not long after he entered the secluded room, he saw Amitabha Buddha right before his eyes. Mad with joy, he began reciting louder and louder and walking faster and faster around the room trying to catch up with Amitabha Buddha. Round and round he went at breakneck speed. The master meditating on an upper floor of the monastery heard his screeching the Buddha's name and knew something was wrong. He went to see what was happening, and as soon as he entered the room, the monk no longer saw Amitabha Buddha. The master, however, saw a huge water buffalo lumbering along in front of the cultivator, egging him on. How could a water buffalo appear as Amitabha Buddha? Heavenly demons and those of outside way sects often appear in forms resembling Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in order to lead people astray. The master immediately realized what was happening and told the bhikshu to relax, slow down, and recite quietly. If the master had not interrupted when he did, the demon probably would have taken a solid grip on the cultivator and rendered him helpless. Why did the water buffalo come to bother this monk? First of all, his lack of cultivation and blatant disregard for the precepts did not equip him with a strong enough foundation for such rigorous cultivation. Secondly, when the master looked more deeply into the matter, he saw that the cultivator had in a past life been an ox which had plowed the fields at a monastery. Because he had amassed merit and good roots from his work, he had been born as a human being and had left the home life. But he still had much of the coarse nature of an ox, and affinities with that species had led a demonic water buffalo to appear to try to deceive him into joining its ranks. He was fortunate that he had drawn near to the venerable master. While the master was involved in construction at Cixing Monastery, the elder Master Yun had heard that in Jiangxi, at Yunju Mountain, the famous old Zhenru Monastery was falling into ruins, and he vowed to go there and restore it. In response to the elder Master Yun's letters exhorting him to do meritorious and virtuous deeds, the master contributed several tens of thousands of Hong Kong dollars to the reconstruction of the hall of the great heroes at Zhenru Monastery. In addition, the master purchased 300 tins of patent gold leaf for gilding the Buddha image there. Fine gold was particularly hard to find in Hong Kong at the time, and so the master had to have it imported from Burma at great expense. In 1955, the Venerable Yun wrote to the master, "Dulun, compassionate one, regard this with your wisdom. Yesterday, Guang Miao came to the mountain bringing many tins of patent gold leaf. In addition to your gracious and meritorious gift, humane one, there is still $1,298.40 needed to fulfill your former resolution to commission the carving of an Amitabha Buddha image. Please send that amount to Guang Miao. Just give him $1,300 Hong Kong. One more thing. Our monastery is still under construction and desperately in need of financial assistance. I hope that you, humane one, will continue to resolve to support us. Also, I hope that if you, humane one, can find time, you will guide Chinese people outside the mainland to come to the mountain for a visit. These are my wishes. Dharma Happiness. Xu Yin, May 23, 1955. Document of Zhenru Chan Monastery, Yunju Mountain. On September 1, 1955, the day of the Buddha's rejoicing, the master held a three-day Ulambana festival at Cixing Monastery. A large gathering of Sangha members and faithful lay followers came to participate. In keeping with the intent of the Ulambana festival, everyone present wished to transfer merit to their deceased relatives and friends, with the hope that the karmic obstacles of the deceased could be removed and their good roots increased. It was hoped that the additional merit transferred to the deceased by their living relatives would carry them to the western paradise of Amitabha Buddha, and that they would certify to the patience of the non-production of dharmas. The performance of the Ulambana rites also allows sons and daughters to repay some of their filial debt. Several of the monks and laymen present at the festival at Cixing Monastery asked the master to transmit precepts to the deceased after the Ulambana festival ceremonies were complete. Among the people in attendance that day, there may have been those who had deeply transgressed against their parents when they were alive, or who had cherished deep affection for a deceased brother, or who had not forgotten their love for a deceased spouse. Thus, each participant profoundly hoped to rescue his kindred from the agony of hanging upside down in the hells. Seeing their sincerity, the master granted their request and had an altar set up on the ground floor of the guest hall at 9:30 in the evening of the 15th day of the 7th lunar month, September 1st. Around 10 o'clock, after the invitation to the sages was delivered, the master sat in stillness, and soon afterwards, the sound of human voices was heard suddenly welling up around the four sides of the precept platform. Everyone realized that it was the liberated ghosts and dead souls who had come to participate in the ceremony and join in the rejoicing. At that very moment, Dharma Master Heng Ye was kneeling before the precept platform, holding aloft the memorial plaque of his deceased father, saw his father appear clearly before him. Meanwhile, two laywomen, Tan Guo Shi and Tan Guo Zheng, who had retired early with the intention of rising at 4 o'clock the following morning to descend the mountain, were already in bed on the second floor of the guest hall. The door of their room was closed. Suddenly, they heard the clamor of human voices and repeated footsteps outside. At first they thought that a large group of people had just arrived at the monastery and were climbing the stairs to spend the night in the guest rooms. As the footsteps passed by, the two laywomen went to their door, opened it a crack, and looked out to see who had come, only to find the corridor absolutely deserted. Puzzled, they closed the door, and immediately the clamor continued as before. By then it began to dawn on them that what they were hearing were ghosts, and the realization caused their hair to stand on end and a chill to run through their bodies. At the same time, the master's disciple, Heng Ding, was quietly cultivating in a small hut several hundred yards from the Buddha Hall. His hut had been built beside a row which provided a shortcut down the mountain, so that any visitors would be sure to pass by his door. The 15th day of the 7th month is also the traditional end of the Sangha's 3-month summer retreat, and as such was a day for the confession of offenses committed during that period. Dharma Master Heng Ding would have gladly confessed his faults, but no one had seen him do anything questionable or heard of any offense he might have committed, and on that evening he simply recited several Buddhist sutras. At 10:30 that night, he became aware of the sound of people walking on the road outside. It sounded like a large group of people climbing down the mountain. He could distinctly hear the tread of their feet and their chatter and laughter as they passed by. Dharma Master Ding thought that probably a group of local people had come up during the day to take part in the ceremonies and were returning home in the evening in the light afforded by the full moon. The next morning, after those who had took breakfast of rice gruel had eaten, everyone discussed what they had seen and heard that evening before, and as the parts of the story unfolded and fit together. The significance of the previous evening's precept ceremony became evident. The group decided to make a record of the event in order to offer evidence of the connection between the death of a person and the coming into existence of a ghost. It is as inevitable as a form's casting a shadow. It is hoped that the record of this incident, as it has been related here, will serve to deepen people's faith and free them from doubts with regard to the truth of the Buddha's teachings. More and more way places began to be founded in Hong Kong, and the Venerable Master rendered his aid in their establishment. He recognized that each new Bodhimanda was a manifestation of the spread of the very same work he was doing, and he felt genuinely a part of each new temple and monastery. If there were mistakes, he considered them his own. In addition to establishing Bodhimandas, the master continued sponsoring the carving and gilding of Buddha images and images of bodhisattvas, sages, and dharma protectors, and saw to the printing and distribution of sutras and Buddhist texts. In accord with the fundamental aim of the Buddha, the Venerable Master's great compassionate heart and deep vows are directed toward saving living beings. To that end, he has undertaken as his moral responsibility the propagation of the Dharma to benefit all sentient beings. The Master regards the commissioning and carving of images as extremely important. Through contemplation and worship before Buddha images, those who have already resolved to become disciples of the Buddha can continually deepen their practice and renew their faith. And for those who have not yet resolved to become disciples, the magnificence of the images can be the inspiration which awakens their faith and kindles their respect so that they are moved to take refuge with the Triple Jewel. Therefore, the Master does not hesitate to spend large sums of money in the employment of skilled craftsmen to carve and gild images. The images he has had commissioned are truly exquisite and are replete with all the intricate details of the 32 marks and the 80 subtle characteristics of the Buddhas. When the Master first came to Hong Kong, he commissioned a thousand-handed, thousand-eyed image of Guanyin Bodhisattva because he wished to pay homage to that Bodhisattva and to cultivate the great compassion dharmas before the image, which depicted the miraculous mudras in a magnificent array of hands and eyes. The image became extremely popular, and many Dharma masters commissioned replicas of the image in the years that followed. In addition to the three images the Master had carved for Western Bliss Gardens and the three images for Tsixing Monastery, he commissioned the carving and gilding of the three Tathagatas, Shakyamuni Buddha, Medicine Master Buddha, and Amitabha Buddha, as well as images of the Bodhisattva Waito and the Bodhisattva Chelan. As mentioned above, he also commissioned himself to provide the image of Amitabha Buddha at Zhenru Monastery in Yunju Mountain, the Bodhimanda of the Venerable Master Yun. He commissioned images of the Great Master Huineng, the sixth patriarch, and of the Venerable Master Yun himself, as well as the Amitabha Buddha at Jurlian Jing Monastery in Hong Kong. The Master commissioned many other images that cannot be specified, for although he is thoroughly public-minded, he does not publicize the innumerable ways in which he benefits living beings. He has said, "It is only necessary that you yourself know that your precepts are purely held, that your cultivation is diligent, that your teaching is appropriate, and that your giving is selfless and beneficial to the Buddha Dharma. If you are proper in your conduct, then it does not matter what others say about you. You yourself know what is true and what is false." In the letter that documented the transmission of the mind-to-mind seal, the Elder Master Yun praised the Master's magnanimous virtue. The letter reads, "Dharma Master Dulun, regard this in light of the way. Several years have already passed since we parted, but you remain foremost in my thoughts. Recently, Upasaka Ko told me in his letter that you, Venerable One, are successful and at ease in your teaching of the Dharma in Hong Kong. I found this comforting. Then your letter addressed in care of Taiping Liansha arrived containing the gift of $600 Hong Kong. Every line of the letter gave me pleasure. Your supreme resolve, Venerable One, to reconstruct this old monastery is a rare and compassionate one, and the merit and virtue of such an offering is hard to come by. It has been almost 3 years since I came to Yunju. Although it is one of the famous former bodhimandas of a patriarch on the mainland, it is now old and the buildings are dilapidated. Once the ragged robed ones got wind of Yun's arrival at this place, they started to come here. So last year I scraped together enough to erect the Dharma Hall, and this spring have continued the restoration of the monastery with repairs on the Great Hall and the Dharma Protectors Hall. Finances are such that it is difficult even to provide daily food for the more than 100 people gathered here. The affinities of you, Venerable One, reach far and wide. Yun hopes that you will use your strength to offer support and help bring the meritorious and virtuous work to accomplishment. How very happy that would make me. Your commissioning of over 10 images of the Buddhas and venerable sages is an outstanding deed. But to have an image of Yun made, how could Yun be worthy of that? It is not permissible. Do not do it. You, Venerable One, have concern for the preservation of the Dharma and for the continuation of the wisdom life of the Buddhas and patriarchs. I am sending you the source, the inheritance of the patriarch's pulse, the patriarch's way. Entrusted to you, it will prosper. This is my hope. This letter has been brief because there is no way to express all there is to say. Dharma Bliss. The ragged-robed Shuyin with palms together, May 18th, 1956. Document of Jinru Monastery on Yunju Mountain. Regarding the Venerable Yun's repeated letters of thanks to the Master for his contributions to the Yunju Jinru Monastery, the Master wrote, I have seen thoroughly the vast extent of the Venerable One's deep concern for those of the future. His humility and modesty are great, for he denies himself everything to be generous to others. He renounces his own will to comply with that of others. His awe-inspiring energy, his matchless compassion, his lofty and venerable way virtue, and his absolutely genuine impartiality cause people to serve him happily and willingly. Buddhist Lecture Hall. The dedication of Sissing Monastery marked the fulfillment of the Master's vow to establish a Bodhimanda on the scale of a monastery in the Hong Kong vicinity. 2 years later, in 1956, the Master went on to establish the Buddhist Lecture Hall. It consisted of the top floor of a 12-story building in Happy Valley, in the heart of the bustling downtown Hong Kong. The top floor had been purchased by Upasika Sha Guoman and other disciples. Guoman had resolved to support the Master in establishing a new temple when she had noticed, to her dismay, that the roof at Western Bliss Garden leaked. Above the Master's bed alone were 7 holes through which water poured when it rained. The Master himself had made no attempt to fix the roof, but instead had pledged several thousand dollars toward the completion of Buddha images for another temple. In all, the repairs would have taken only a couple of $100s, but the Master did not use money for his own benefit. Why should the master have to endure such suffering? Guaman exclaimed, and resolved to purchase the Happy Valley real estate to provide the master with another Bodhimanda in a location that would be a convenient center for cultivators. Since the time of its establishment, a round of ceremonies, Buddha recitation sessions, repentance ceremonies, lectures, vegetarian feasts, and other such Buddhist events have kept the lecture hall filled with devoted disciples and interested guests to this day. One entire wall of the lecture hall is composed of windows through which the sunlight streams. In the small kitchen adjoining the long narrow back porch, vegetarian foods are dried, pickled, preserved, washed, strained, chopped, cooked, and served with expert efficiency to monks, nuns, and lay people who gather by the hundreds to make offerings and plant blessings during celebrations of the birth, leaving home, enlightenment, and nirvana of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, patriarchs, and sages. A library of sutras, shastras, and vinaya, as well as a full Chinese Tripitaka, is housed in the main hall. Since the lecture hall is on the top floor, there is also easy access to the flat roof, which provides a place for growing plants, herbs, and flowers used as offerings to the Triple Jewel. The adjoining flat is also used as a hall of worship. Sessions, celebrations, and feasts are held there in conjunction with events in the lecture hall, and the combined area provides ample room to accommodate large gatherings. When the lecture hall was established, many people came to call, among them many Dharma masters. On one occasion, Dharma Master Ye Shi, who had gained the reputation of being a very learned and superior old cultivator, came to visit. He wore his hair long to distinguish himself as an ascetic, although this was usually the practice only of monks who cultivated deep in the mountains, not like Ye Shi in the heart of the city. Soon after he arrived, the master wrote the first half of a matched couplet and said to Dharma Master Ye Shi, "If you can write the companion verse to this, I will call you an old cultivator. If you cannot, I will pronounce you an old demon king." The line which the master wrote read, "In the white water, spring is one vast sky." The first character, white, and the second character, water, combine to make the third character, spring. The fourth character, which stands in the center of the line, is middle. The fifth character, one, and the sixth character, vast, combine to make the last character, sky. So in order to match it, Dharma Master Ye Shi would have had to duplicate the pattern of characters' construction. Ye Shi spent a half an hour pondering the line, but he couldn't come up with a companion line to complete the verse. So the master wrote another verse which says, "With disheveled hair and a filthy face, the old demon king goes about causing people to discuss strong points and shortcomings. Put it down. Don't put it down." Then when Dharma Master Ye Shi prepared to take leave, the master accompanied him to the door, and just as he was about to walk out, the master grabbed him by his long hair. The master pulled back on that handful of hair until Yeshi went down on his knees. And then the master peered down into his face and said, "You old demon king, let's see how much spiritual skill you have. Let's see you get out of this one. Come on, come on." Why did Yeshi deserve such a severe scolding? It was because when he first came to Hong Kong, he announced that he was the teacher of the elder master Shuyin, and so acquired a reputation for spiritual skill. Some of Master Yun's disciples in Hong Kong were deceived by Yeshi, and in addition to treating him with the utmost respect because of this fraudulent claim, they lavished offerings on him as someone to be venerated as their master's teacher. Eventually, one of the disciples wrote to the Venerable Yun to tell him that his teacher had arrived in Hong Kong. The elder master replied, "I have heard of that long-bearded monk. So he says he's my teacher." He did not say he was his teacher, and he did not say he wasn't. But his letter made it immediately clear that the Hong Kong disciples had been taken in by a hoax. When they challenged Yeshi, he became indignant. "Your master came to bow to me when he was just a child and told me he wanted to leave home, but I wouldn't accept him. He knelt in front of me with tears streaming down his face and his nose running, but I still wouldn't accept him," and sent him away. One only need be reminded that the elder Master Yun was well over 100 years old at the time to realize the fallacy in the obviously younger Yeshi's story. On another occasion, the master encountered a layman whom he immediately recognized to be the living Arhat Wu Jin, whom he had met years previously at Lingyan Monastery in Suzhou. The man whom the master had warned to stop displaying his spiritual penetrations and randomly curing people was no longer a living Arhat, however. He had changed into a common person. He had returned to lay life. "What happened?" asked the master. "Where did your living Arhat go? How did you end up like this?" "Because you said I would have a downfall. I have actually had one," Wu Jin said accusingly. "If you hadn't said that, how could this possibly have happened to me?" "There's too much magic in your words. You said I would fall, and so now I have fallen." "Well, you've had your downfall, and I said I would save you when it happened so you can leave home again," replied the master. It is customary for lay people to donate money upon leaving the home life, so Wu Jin's reply was, "I haven't any money. I cannot afford to leave home." "I'll give you the money," said the master. And so the layman left home once more. After he again became a bhikshu, he resided at Dharma Master Xi Chen's temple, and Xi Chen treated him like a living Buddha. Every day after morning and evening recitation, Dharma Master Xi Chen would bow to Wu Jin. Observing his conduct, the master warned Xi Chen, saying, "You had better be careful. If you treat him that respectfully, he will have another downfall." And sure enough, after a while, nobody seemed to know what happened to him, but the living Arhat just wasn't around anymore. "I've met a lot of people who have had a downfall," said the master. "That living Arhat sat up all the time and ate only once a day, but just the same, he had a downfall. It is clear that cultivating the way is not easy." In the hasty withdrawal of Sangha members from the mainland, many Dharma treasures had to be left behind. Among these were many copies of the sutras. Aware of the critical shortage of Dharma in Hong Kong, the Venerable Master continually contributed toward the printing of hundreds of thousands of volumes of sutra texts, and constantly urged others to join in this meritorious work. It is through the Buddhist sutras that the doctrines of Buddhism are expressed, and by printing and reprinting the text, people can accrue blessings and can benefit countless numbers of living beings. Sutras are like indispensable lamps on a dark road, like food for famine-stricken people. If there were no sutras, gods and men would be plunged into perpetual night. Therefore, to translate, print, and circulate Buddhist sutras, or the entire Tripitaka, is to preserve the very lifeblood of one's own wisdom. Consequently, the Master initiated the reprinting of the Universal Door Chapter of the Lotus Sutra, the Earth Store Sutra, the Vajra Sutra, the Sharangama Sutra, the Heart Sutra, and the entire Avatamsaka Sutra, and many others. The Buddhist Lecture Hall became the publisher of thousands of editions of texts. Although the vow to print sutras may seem a simple matter on the surface, carrying it out required a vast measure of strength, forbearance, and wisdom. At the end of the 24-volume set of the Avatamsaka Sutra, printed by the Buddhist Lecture Hall, there appears this statement by the Master, entitled, Reflections Upon the Completion of the Printing of the Great Expanse Buddha Avatamsaka Sutra. I, who lived humbly in a hut by my mother's grave, have read many sutras. When I first read the Lotus Sutra, I was mad with delight. I knelt and recited it for 7 days and 7 nights, forgetting to sleep, forgetting to eat, until eventually blood flowed from my eyes and my vision dimmed. Then I read the Sharangama, thoroughly investigating the great samadhi and quietly cultivating it. The three stoppings, the three contemplations, neither moving nor still, I began to obtain a single-minded profound stillness and penetrate the noumenal nature. When I read the Avatamsaka, the enlightenment became boundless in its scope, indescribable in its magnificence, unsurpassed in its loftiness, and ineffable in its clarity. National Master Qingliang said, Opening and disclosing the meritorious and subtle, understanding and expanding the mind and its states, exhausting the principle while fathoming the nature, penetrating the result which includes the cause, deep and wide and interfused, vast and great, and totally complete. It is certainly so. It is certainly so. At that time I could not put down the text, and bowed to and recited the great sutra, as if it were clothing for which one must not part, or food which one could not do without for even a day. And I vowed to myself to see to its vast circulation. Then, when Vinaya Master Zihang completed the stillness, those who had studied with him and others participated in a 7-day Avatamsaka Sutra recitation session held at this hall. At that time, they decided to print the sutra. But because the Dharma-ending age abounds with obstructions, two or three laymen began scheming about taking control and running the operation for a profit. Their attempts were all unsuccessful, however, and the printing of the sutra was postponed. What a pity that it had to drag on so long that now I have to oversee the printing personally, in order that the vows made by the people who attended that session can be fulfilled. I hope that the good and wise advisors, both here and abroad, who have subscribed to this sutra, will excuse Lun for his ineptness in handling this matter. I could wish for nothing more than that. Respectfully, Mountain Monk Shir Dulun, Buddhist Lecture Hall, Hong Kong, Headquarters for the Printing of the Avatamsaka Sutra, July 16, 1957. In 1957, the master traveled to Thailand and Singapore, and at the invitation of layman John Hatun, president of the Burmese Sasana Council, he went on to Burma. On his tours of that country, which included visits to Pegu and Damadut College, he was escorted by Mr. Hatun and by C.T. Dan of the Council of the Union of Burma. In Rangoon, the master led hundreds of Rangoon Buddhists in the circumambulation of the Rangoon Pagoda as they recited the Buddha's name. Later, he joined other monks in meditation before the colossal statue of the reclining Buddha. Everywhere he went, people were deeply affected by the magnitude of the master's way virtue, and were particularly moved to respect and veneration by his awesome demeanor and compassionate appearance. Affinities were so deep that upon his departure from that country, thousands of Buddhist disciples and well-wishers gathered at the airport where they knelt and recited the Buddha's name to pay their respects. And as he rose to leave, they wept. After the master's return to the Buddhist lecture hall, many disciples came to pay their respects. Among them was a laywoman who enjoyed many blessings but had never been granted her wish for a son. She came on that day with a specific request set firmly in her mind. After she bowed to the master, she began imploring him to grant her a son. "I have always wanted one desperately, and now I am no longer young. Please use your powers to fulfill my deepest desire." She went on quite insistently, becoming more and more emotional, until finally she was weeping and saying that she would do anything if only her request would be granted. The master, who during the entire scene had been washing his feet in a basin, began drying them, and pointing to the basin of dirty water, said, "Drink that." The laywoman paused momentarily in her entreaty to laugh offhandedly at the master's comment, and then renewed her pleas with even greater fervor. The master finished drying his feet and listened patiently for several more minutes. When he saw that she had no intention of drinking the dirty water, he reached down, lifted the basin to his lips, and slowly began drinking. At the sight, the woman instantly broke off her tirade, and for a few moments, not a sound was heard in the lecture hall except that of the master's swallowing. When he finished drinking the basinful of foot-washing water, the master said quietly to the woman, "You said you would do anything for a son, but when I told you to drink the water, you didn't believe me. Well, if you had drunk the water, you would have gotten your son. In Buddhism, one must eat what others cannot eat, do what others cannot do, endure what others cannot endure. and then there is surely a response. You will have to seek somewhere else for a son. I have done all I can. In 1958, the master founded the San Francisco Buddhist Lecture Hall. With the help of his disciples, Tan Guo Shir and Tan Guo Zheng, who were residing in the United States. As word of the master's way virtue, compassion, and miraculous deeds spread, many people in the United States petitioned to be allowed to take refuge by proxy with the master, sight unseen. Meanwhile, at Yunju Mountain, the Venerable Yun made a valuable contribution to the treasury of Dharma by compiling and publishing volumes of Dharma portraits of the patriarchs, accompanied by his own verses of praise. He wrote in the letter to the master, "Dulin, humane one, regard this with your wisdom. For a long time I have not asked after you. I only pray that in your benefiting of living beings everything will be as you will. With this letter, I am sending a copy of the recently published Book of Prints of Buddhas and Patriarchs, a treasure of the way and a remembrance. I hope that you will benefit yourself and benefit others in your work for the Buddha Dharma, and that you will take care. Dharma Bliss, Shuyin, with palms together, January 10th, 1958. The Elder Master's Nirvana and the Old Monk in the Grave. Almost a decade had passed since the Master had left Yunmen in 1949, and his promise to the Elder Master Yun that he would certainly return remained unfulfilled. In 1959, the Master received another letter from the Elder Yun, instructing him to return to Yunju Monastery. Commenting on the letter, the Master relates, "While in Dhyana contemplation, I came to know that the Elder Master wished to transfer the responsibilities of Junru to me. But for various reasons, I could not heed the command. Even now, my regret knows no bounds." That year, the Elder Master Yun fell gravely ill. The Master received the news in July, and day and night he was not at ease. I had noticed in the Venerable One's Dharma portrait of 1958 that his eyes gazed levelly out through his eyebrows, which were so long they could have been tucked behind his ears. When I saw the portrait, I bowed before it and was moved to say, "The Venerable One almost always closes his eyes in his portraits, but this time the compassionate eyes are gazing on living beings. This is very unusual. It must be indication of a major change. In less than a year, it will become clear." Then the Master requested the greatly virtuous Sangha of the Ten Directions to bow on behalf of the Elder Master Yun, the repentance of Medicine Master Buddha, who dispels calamities and lengthens life. He arranged for several days of universal bowing to the Buddhas and put a notice in the newspaper to let all the Elder One's disciples know, so that by the combined strength of the assembly's determination and sincerity, a response would come to pass. At the opening of the Dharma assembly, the Master said, "I fear that this is the last opportunity for us to practice universal bowing before the Buddhas, to bow the Medicine Master repentance, and to perform other ceremonies for the Elder Master Yun. There will be no further chance. The master's voice was so laden with sorrow as he spoke these words that those who heard him wept silently. Then a letter came from Yunju saying, "The Venerable One is a little better. We are deeply relieved." The master immediately concentrated all his attention on finding an artist who could be commissioned for the painting of the Elder One's pictorial biography. The biography includes 200 exquisite Chinese brush drawings. In 10,000 characters written by the master, it sets forth the Elder One's life of superior Wei virtue, his conduct and vows, the hardships he suffered, his toil, and his singular energy and spirit. The Elder Master is shown as an eternal model and guide for the sages who will come in the future. There has not been a model such as he in thousands of years, the master writes. Unfortunately, death is inevitable. On October 16, 1959, the master received a message that on October 12th at 1:45 p.m., the Venerable One, at the age of 120, had entered nirvana at Zhenru Chan Monastery on Yunju Mountain. His instructions for those who would come after him were to diligently cultivate precepts, samadhi, and wisdom, and put to rest greed, anger, and stupidity, to forget themselves for the sake of the Dharma, and to respect one another. When the master heard this news, suddenly not only did the mountains collapse and the earth quake, but the whole world and everyone in it disappeared as the disaster of fire blazed through everything. He could not tell if he was dreaming or awake, if things were real or illusory. He was as lifeless as a puppet, as senseless as a clay image. After a while, he came to his senses. He experienced an overwhelming grief. The next day, on the morning of October 17th, the master called together all the temple's donors to discuss what was appropriate for the occasion. They decided to hold a 21 Buddha recitation session followed by a 120-day Great Prajna recitation session. They hoped in this way to repay the elder master for the kindness of the Dharma milk, which he had so mercifully given them. Then they telephoned overseas, telling Dharma companions so that they could participate from afar. Among those called were the Buddhist Lecture Hall in San Francisco, the Buddhist Association of Honolulu, the Singapore Buddhist Association, Layman Li Jun Cheng, and Layman Bi Jun Hai, and others in Hawaii, Layman Yu Jun Dong, Chairman of the World Buddhist Friendship Association, Layman John Lee Wu in Canada, and other disciples in Taiwan, Burma, Thailand, India, Ceylon, and other countries. More than 100 telegrams were sent to ensure that disciples throughout the world received word, so that in response they would all commemorate the nirvana of the Elder One. Leaders of all the Buddhist associations in the Republic of China were notified of the Elder Master's nirvana. And on October 19th, all the newspapers in Hong Kong printed the news along with the plans for the memorial services and other observances. During the 3 months and 3 week Amitabha Buddha and Great Prajna Sutra recitation sessions held in Buddhist Lecture Hall in memory of the Venerable Elder Master Zhu Yin, the following daily schedule was maintained. 5:45, rise. 6, morning rice gruel. 7 to 7:30, recitation of the Great Prajna Sutra. 8 to 9, recitation of the Sutra. 9:30 to 10:30, recitation of the Sutra, transference of merit, high offering. 11, noon meal. 1:30 to 2:30, recitation of the Sutra. 3 to 4, recitation of the Sutra. 4:45, evening food. 7 to 9, recitation of the Sutra. 10, rest. Expenses for the Amitabha Buddha and Great Prajna Sutra recitation sessions for a period of 161 days came to 6,791 Hong Kong dollars. Donations made to the session covered 3,850 Hong Kong dollars of the expenses. The deficit was made up as an offering by the Master Hua. On November 4, 1959, the Master sent two lay disciples, Xie Guo Feng and Ma Guo Xian, to Yunju to receive an offering of relics, sharira, that remained after the Elder Master's cremation. On the 7th of November, the two disciples arrived at Zhenru Monastery and obtained more than a dozen sharira of rare brilliance, which emitted a light of five colors. After a two-day return journey, the disciples arrived at the lecture hall in the afternoon of the 18th. The Master led the two through the great assembly while everyone offered incense and flowers and made prostrations and obeisance to welcome them. Everyone was extremely happy, the Master relates, and I felt as if a great weight had been lifted off my shoulders. I felt buoyant and was well content. The next day, four laymen, Mao Wanda, Li Zhenyu, Xie, and Ma, accompanied the Master to take the sharira to pay a call on the elder layman Chen. At that time, they discussed the publication of a book to be entitled Memorial to the Elder High Master Xuyin's Nirvana. Layman Chen suggested that time be allowed for the receipt of articles from overseas. On the basis of his suggestion, the publication was gradually compiled, published, and circulated. The Venerable Elder Yun's verse of bequest reads, "Out of kind regard for the life of the ants, the shrimp don't hop back to the water, that I might pacify aquatic creatures. Please toss my body in the river. I pray that all who partake of my offering of body and vows will in turn prove to Bodhi and rescue living beings. I hope that my Dharma companions will not be sad or worried about me. The karma of birth and death surrounds us as the cocoon binds the silkworm that has spun it. Greed and confusion are endless, and yet those who are entrapped in them still feel happy. If you wish to be rid of this trouble, you should cultivate diligently and refine yourself until a wonderful tallying with the unproduced occurs and you gain a thorough understanding of the basic nature. Through cutting off the emotions of love and hate, you can be released from the dangerous turning wheel. As you work to purify the three studies, firmly hold to the four dwellings in mindfulness and vow to become perfectly accomplished. Your body is like an illusion, a dewdrop or a lightning flash. When you certify and awaken to true emptiness, the myriad dharmas become one substance. Separation and union, sadness and joy, are as insubstantial as bubbles. After I die and this transformation body is finished, please take my bones and ash and grind them into powder. Mix the powder with oil, sugar, and flour. Roll it into pellets and then place these in the river as an offering to the aquatic creatures. I will be forever thankful if you grant my wish in repayment of my debts to mankind. Xu Yun bows. In announcing the news of the memorial services for the Elder Master Yun, the Master had no other motive than his knowledge that the more who came to participate sincerely, the greater the dedication of merit to the Elder Yun would be. But despite the sincerity of the Master's intent, there were those who could not control themselves and gave vent to jealousy by spreading rumors and gossip. They tried to convince others that the Master had no legitimate connection with the Venerable Master Yun at all. Of this situation, the Master wrote, "Who would have thought that this would arouse people's jealousy? Evildoers began slandering and demonic ghosts went mad. They became so totally confused that they did not distinguish clearly what they saw and heard. Those self-made good advisors convinced not only themselves but impartial bystanders to follow along and join in their campaign. How pitiful! It is easy to believe the saying that when the deeds are good, the demons abound. When all is said and done, I leave it for the Venerable Yun to decide. Have I done right? And in the same way, only the Venerable Yun can know. Have I committed offenses?" When Confucius wrote the Spring and Autumn's Annals, the corrupt officials and thieves recoiled in dread. When Sima wrote history, he put an end to villains and criminals. I will devote all my strength to the Venerable Yun. Although 10,000 insects may sting my body, I am absolutely not afraid. Proceed to aim your clever machinations at me. I will gladly withstand them. The 120-day Great Prajna Recitation Session in memory of the Elder Master Yun and the accusations that came from jealous people who did not participate together marked the end of the Master's 10 years in Hong Kong. Immediately following the completion of the 120-day session, the Master left for Australia. At that time, there was little knowledge of Buddhism in Australia, and there were no monasteries of any importance. Heeding the 5th Patriarch's advice to the 6th Patriarch, "Do not speak too soon. The Buddha Dharma arises from difficulties." The Master guarded the mind seal, deepening his cultivation, and waited for the right time. But even then, the difficulties did not cease. Because Buddhism was so little known in Australia, people did not make offerings to the Master, and soon he had to resort to eating pan-fried orange rinds in the attempt to sustain himself. After a few weeks of this diet, his hands grew numb and shook so violently that he could not even write. About that time, however, the Master was offered a position to teach Chinese at an Australian university. The Master spent a quiet year in Australia and then returned to Hong Kong briefly before setting out for America. The journey by airplane to America included a stopover in Japan, where the Master spent about 10 days. Unfortunately, the jealousies had not subsided, and while in Japan, the Master visited a temple where several Chinese Dharma masters were residing. As soon as he entered their company, he was aware of their acute jealousy. And although it was his practice not to take food after noon, when tea and refreshments were brought out, The master decided to take a bite of food so as not to appear to be too different from the others and risk arousing their jealousies even more. He accepted 6 or 7 fried soybeans and ate them. Immediately, he knew that he had made a grave mistake. The beans were loaded with deadly poison. Although he realized it right away, he chose not to give any indication that he knew and did not dispel the poison from his body at once, as the first patriarch of China, Bodhidharma, had done when he spit it out on a tray, and another time on a rock when he was poisoned by jealous bhikshus. Although the poison did not kill the master, it lodged in a single place in his body, and a painful sore formed on his ankle. Having been unsuccessful at poisoning the master to death, one of the jealous Chinese Dharma masters went on ahead to San Francisco, the master's destination, to campaign against him. After the founding of the Buddhist Lecture Hall in San Francisco in 1958, word had spread and many people had sought to take refuge with him, sight unseen. But when the jealous and obstructive Dharma master arrived in San Francisco, he used every method in his power to dissuade people from believing in the master. "He claims he never eats after noon, but I watched him with my own eyes while he ate one afternoon in Japan," reported the Dharma master, failing altogether to mention the fact that he and his Dharma brothers had put poison in the food they served. So skilled and persuasive was he with his slander that he soon instilled serious doubt in the minds of many of the faithful who had planned to welcome the master at the airport upon his arrival in America. And they changed their mind and decided not to go. After a brief stopover in Hawaii, the master set out on the last leg of his journey to America. Not fearing the difficulty of a new beginning, he was determined to protect the embodiment of the mind-to-mind seal of all generations. But at the same time, he was carrying a lethal dose of poison in his body. It was for both these reasons that he soon came to be known as the old monk in the grave. What happened next? The details must wait for a later telling. In general, the master remained in the grave for 8 years. And shortly after he emerged, he wrote the following verse, which describes the experience. "Each of you now meets a monk in a grave. Above there is no sun and moon. Below there is no lamp. Afflictions and enlightenment. Ice is water. Let go of self-seeking and be apart from all that is false. When the mad mind ceases, enlightenment pervades all. Enlightened, attain to the bright store of the self-nature." Basically, the retribution body is the Dharma body. Commenting on the verse, the master said, "Now you are meeting a monk who is in the grave." "How did you get there?" someone asked. "I don't know either." "You should not ask that question. It is not important. How the monk got in the grave and how he got out does not pose a problem. It is not necessary to talk about it."